Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Life doesn't always go according to plan, and while we can't control life's challenges and events, we can control our responses. Our next guest on Open House has done just that, demonstrating resilience, demonstrating hope during heartbreaking periods in his life. Doug Spann shows how life can still be wonderful, even when it doesn't seem to be. He was working as a management executive when his wife left, leaving him as a single father of four. He moved to Sydney for a new life and also met his new love, Sharon. In a carefree, happy place at a Neil Finn concert, Sharon went into an inexplicable mental state and was rushed to hospital. She was diagnosed with a brain disease, encephalitis, unable to speak or communicate. It ultimately claimed her life. Doug has continued his quest to find answers, researching brain and mind diseases, because it's something that's infected his entire life. His parents both died of stroke. His grandmother had a brain aneurysm. His first wife suffers from paranoid schizophrenia. His eldest child has Rett syndrome. What a life. Doug Spann has documented his story in his new book called Eyes of Silence, which I expect will be a help to many. And it will also open lots of eyes. In fact, 3 in every 100 young adults will experience at least one psychotic episode, making it more common than diabetes in that age group. Doug Spann, welcome to Open House.
Thanks, Lou.
So grateful for you coming in and sharing your story. And what a story. Like so many others, though, in different ways, off the back of your early life, back then, who'd have ever thought what you'd be facing up to?
Yeah, absolutely. I was totally ignorant of, life generally. I guess I was pretty naive. I grew up a happy sort of kid and, in a pretty happy family. So, yeah, hadn't really considered what life would or wouldn't bring.
You were kind of eased into what you later went on to experience with your parents, your grandmum, both affected by brain disease.
Yeah, I didn't know my grandmother because my mum and dad sort of escaped out of East Germany and before I was born, so I was the only one born here in Australia. But my grandmother did have a brain aneurysm, so I knew that later on. But mum and dad, both suffered strokes in their 70s, so they were, into life. But and then subsequently found out that stroke is actually a neurological disorder. So
yes.
So the sort of connecting pieces started to build then.
Then to your first wife. Day to day, can you explain to us what it is like living with a person suffering paranoid schizophrenia?
Hugely unpredictable, enormously frustrating, because from the outside you're trying to help and do what you can with somebody that you love, and that was always very difficult. Erratic behaviour, so just all sorts of like she wouldn't be there some days. I mean, I'd get home from work on occasionally and the whole family would be gone. She wouldn't ring for 24 hours and then be on either a woman's shelter. That happened on a number of occasions. She flew back to Perth with the kids once, come home from a sort of full-on day and, there'd be no sort of food on the table, or the place was an absolute, mess. She withdrew from society too, so we found it very difficult. I felt for her because she felt very difficult to really connect with people, form solid relationships. So it was always very difficult as a partnership to try and build friendships outside of the family. So, yeah.
I can barely begin to understand how you cope with that.
I don't know myself, to be honest with you, Lee. I think it's my makeup. I just have a belief system that says you just got to... there's something I use. It's like not what happens to you, it's how you respond to what happens to you that determines your destiny. And I've sort of stuck with that. And so to me, it's just like, okay, I got to do what I got to do. And you just got to keep moving. And that some of that might be my family German background. Dad was very pragmatic and just soldiered through lots of adversity. So that's just the way I approached it.
How'd it affect your kids?
It affected them in all sorts of ways, I think still does, to be honest. My youngest now is 19, but the boys have sort of had different difficulties over the recent years just with dealing with stuff, and I think it really had a major effect on them. At the time, certainly, I'm sure they were confused, really not really sure what was going on. But that was my main focus personally, was to ensure that the kids had as much normality as possible, and if I could provide that, that would be my number one goal.
So it got even deeper. As I said, with your eldest child, they suffer from Rett syndrome. Can you explain to us what that is first?
In layman's terms, that's a global developmental delay. So it's a chromosomal disorder. Chloe was 12 months, pretty normal sort of progression, development. What happens is this particular thing kicks in, and she would lose all the things that she'd had developed in terms of motor skills, walking skills, stuff like that. So really from about 12 months, she was normal. Then all of a sudden, she started losing her ability to walk, climb, you know, feed, all that sort of stuff. And so it's what we call global developmental delay. So she's now 27 and has the intellectual and physical capacity of maybe a 12-month-old.
Did you ever get to a time where you thought, I can't deal with any more of this?
Yeah, a couple of times. I have to say there was one time in particular I came home from work, one of those moments. I think there was, you know, there was bills and a whole range of other things going on. So I remember going to the bedroom and you know, closing the door, locking it and sitting down and for a fleeting second thinking if I had something that I could do myself some harm with, I'd probably do it right now.
What brought you back?
My faith, actually. You know, just sat there and prayed. Really, I think at that time I really just went to where God was. That then just said, Doug, you just got to take that next step. Life does get better. There is hope. I mean, I wear a little band that, you know, has hope on it all the time. So to me, it's just what I live by and sort of pick myself up and got on with it, really.
Then your fiance, when things seem to be going well in your life, can you take us into that Neil Finn concert and explain what happened that night?
Sharon was feeling odd and ill for a few months before that, flu-like type symptoms, generally lethargic at the end of a week. You know, that wasn't her style, so she was very effervescent, uplifting sort of lady. But we, you know, she was excited to go to Neil Finn. He was in Melbourne for a pretty intimate concert. She was a big fan of his. We went along, and she was excited during the course of the day. And when we got there, you know, probably an hour or so in, she just, her mood just changed. She was agitated. She just wanted to sort of get out of there. She was saying, look, let's just go. I was saying, hang on a minute, you know, you're having a great time, all of that stuff. It just sort of descended from there, really. And we left about maybe an hour before the show ended. And it was in the car on the way home that it really hit home, in that she started to talk about things that I didn't see or witness. And I knew from my previous experience that she was hallucinating. And so that put fear through me and terror, not really sure where this was going. And, you know, thinking it might be similar to what I'd experienced. So, yeah, it just sort of started to fall apart from there.
Were you panicking?
I was not panicking. I was fearful, bottom of the gut type feeling where you're going to be sick and thinking, oh, my God, here we go again. This is a similar scenario. I was feeling for her. You know, she was somebody I loved dearly and had changed my life considerably. So all of that was going on in my head and a bit of confusion, not really sure what really to do at that sort of moment. Should I take her home? Should I take her to the hospital? That type of thing.
How did it play out from then on?
Took her home. She did actually calm down a bit. So she sort of started to get a little bit more coherent and put her to bed. And then the following day, really tried to get her to see our local doctor just to sort of take that first step. Very rapidly went from there to getting into hospital and then having to commit her actually to the mental health ward in St. Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne. They wanted to let her go because by the time she got to hospital, she seemed to calm again. But I knew what, you know, the consequences could have been. So it was pretty heart-wrenching in having to leave her there. But that was the best thing for her, I thought. Within 24 hours, she was drugged up with antipsychotic drugs. I think not long after that in the emergency ward at St. Vincent's, because she wasn't hydrating and you know, taking fluid and she started showing signs of rigidity in her limbs. And within, I think it was a day and a bit, she was in ICU in a catatonic state. So not being able to communicate in any way, you know, eyes open, but certainly no communication coming from her.
How long did she last?
4 months, just on 4 months. I think we didn't get a diagnosis for 3.5. I think the doctors knew, I mean, they treat things, what I know now is they do treat things in some sort of chronological fashion. So there was a suspect that she had, you know, possibly got a virus that had got into her brain. So treated her for that, but we didn't get a definitive diagnosis until about 3.5 months in.
So it's something any of us could face.
Yeah, what I've learned since is, I mean, you wouldn't want to think about it because it would depress you, but
yes,
there's, you know, there's hundreds of viruses out there floating around, and there's only a couple that I think you can actually treat, which is the herpes virus is one of them. But a virus got into her body, got into her bloodstream, went up to her brain, inflamed it, and then, you know, went away after a week or so, and then you're left with the damage that it does.
I feel like asking you the same question again. How did you deal with all that on top of everything else?
I don't know. I really don't know the answer in terms of how I do it. I go into a bit of a structured mode. So it was like, okay, I need to care for her. I need to make sure my kids are okay and care for them. Foolishly, I was also trying to embark on a different role at work and do something differently. And so a whole lot of these things were coming together. But I just wanted to ensure that I did what I possibly could to understand what was going on and then give her as much love and comfort and support as I could.
To say nothing of your kids.
Exactly. Be there for them and try to have some normality in life. So it did, after a few weeks just start to get into a bit of a process in terms of the daily activities, and that provided some normality for the children.
It's all the more impressive that you've turned it around to really focus on research and investigation for treatment of brain disease. What have you found out? What's the future like?
The future is actually quite good. I mean, I've become friends with a number of professors within the neurological space, and what I do know is that it doesn't have, because conditions of the brain and mind, so that's brain disease like neurological disease or mental disorders, you know, mental illness.
Yeah,
they're very individual. People will have experience of some way, shape or form, but in a holistic sense, it hasn't got the same level of awareness in the community as cancer and heart disease. Yet conditions of the brain and mind actually disable more people. So it's actually the largest burden on the health budget, for example. There is more disablement, so people actually live with disablement, so carers and the infrastructure that goes with it. But it just doesn't have the same level of social conscience. So, you know, people will connect to stroke or, you know, Alzheimer's or something like that. But to be able to do more from a research perspective, what I have found is that there's lots of great, talented researchers. Research is the key, but it's being done very disparately in sort of areas, and a lot of competitiveness. So it's not actually collaborative by nature. You know, one of the things I was told by Professor Byrne was that, you know, Alzheimer's, for example, which is something like a $6 billion a year burden on Australian health, could be cured in 10 years' time. We could have a cure for Alzheimer's, or at least a very significant treatment plan. Now, that's going to make a huge impact. And there's, So there's lots of positive things going on in the brain and mind world, which I'm not a medico, I'm just a guy, but what I've found is quite exciting. So,
perhaps in terms of public perception, it's a scary arena to enter and so unpredictable.
Totally unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know, I've got another case, our next-door neighbour, actually. Her niece has just been struck down with a brain-related condition. It's completely rare, completely bizarre, 15 or 16 years old, suffering massively, and you go, there is no cure for that. So, you know, it can just strike randomly like that. A lot of it does strike fear in, but the brain is fundamental to the whole functioning system of the body.
From your experience, what do you tell her parents?
First thing I say is you got to have hope. Without hope, you got nothing. So it's difficult in circumstances like that. So you have to have empathy with people when they're going through their pain and their story. Just questioning things. I questioned, not that I distrusted the medical fraternity, but just ask questions, get yourself informed. I guess a hard thing is you cannot control it, and that's where faith comes in for me. It's not up for me to sort of determine where that goes. I've just got to sort of deal with it as best I possibly can. So, but you've got to have hope. You've got to believe that all things are possible.
Although sometimes it might seem hopeless.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And there were times during Sharon's time in hospital that I felt utterly hopeless, frustrated and angry and all those sort of emotions that, you know, people would go through that sort of situation. But ultimately, it's a choice. You just got to keep moving. Otherwise, you'd fall apart.
There must have been times when you'd cry out to God, maybe in anger, certainly in despair.
Totally in despair. I think there were times when I was angry, but I wasn't angry at him. It was more about trying to understand the purpose, where this was going. I didn't really question why, Sharon. I mean, there probably were fleeting moments because I had the same experience with my daughter and, you know, my first wife. So you get through saying life is like that. Life has a funny way of working out one way or another. But everybody has tragedy in their lives in one way, shape or form, or a story to tell. So I don't think I'm unique in that sense. So you just say, okay, what am I going to do? What does this do in terms of me and the people I'm with? And how do I make a good situation out of something quite horrible? And that's how I sort of viewed it. Doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. Doesn't mean I don't get emotional. Doesn't mean I don't cry and feel the pain. But it just means that if I can do something good with this, in whatever way, give people hope, you know, if I can encourage them in one way, shape or form, whatever it might be, then that's a positive thing.
Talk to me about that hope. So where have you found hope then? What's that look like? What's that feel like to you?
I'm now remarried, so I've, you know, hope is that I found another woman who I can't believe would be interested in a man that's had this background, you know, kids. I come with a lot of baggage. So to find love again in that context is miraculous in my mind. I just didn't think that would ever happen again. I'd, you know, just grow old as a single bloke and you know, the kids will grow up and have grandkids or whatever, and we'll see what happens. But so to do that is hope, and that came totally out of left field. So it was nothing that was planned. I honestly think that's the plan of my life, that, you know, that was before me. So I just go with the flow, and that type of thing is wonderful. You know, life is good. My children have grown up and become great people, great adults in their own way, in shape and form. The ability to influence people in a positive way is also enriching and lovely. So, yeah, there is hope. There's always hope in difficult situations.
And there's now the book, Eyes of Silence. Why write a book about this, and why that title?
The book was essentially in diary format originally. What I found about a brain injury is that patients do suffer short-term memory loss. So the idea was to say to Sharon when she woke up, and I had hoped she would, here, babe, here's the last 4 months of your life or 3 months, whatever. You know, you may want to read it, you may not, but, you know, because you won't remember what's happened, yes. This might fill in some of the gaps. That was the general intent. And the other intent was to inform her family. She had an elderly mum and dad in country Victoria and one sibling, one younger sister, and was that they weren't always there. So I was sharing the information with them. And it started to then be so that was the original intent when I started the diary. Then it just became a dialogue to communicate and connect with her. Because she was catatonic, she couldn't respond, she couldn't speak. For all intents and purposes, she didn't even know I was there. So I tried to do normal things like read to her and, you know, wash her hair and massage her feet and things like that. This thing just became my expression of love and how I could communicate with her and feel like I was normal. So when she died, I literally left it for about 6 months. And a lady I worked with read it and, you know, wanted the story. And she read the basic manuscript and said, "Have you thought about getting it published?" And I thought, no, it wasn't really for that reason. And what Sharon was diagnosed with ultimately was made famous by a guy called Oliver Sacks, who was a famous neurologist in New York. And he wrote a book called Awakenings, which became a movie with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. And Oliver Sacks was in Melbourne for the Writers' Festival at exactly the same time Tina said. So I figured that was destiny. That was like, hey, it's a God moment. Yeah. So I tried to approach him in Melbourne. I couldn't do that, but I did go to New York and meet him later. And it started the journey of telling Sharon's story, which I think was worthwhile to tell, that her life had significance. It wasn't just a moment in time. To encourage people that are going through any sort of difficulty. That was what I'm really trying to do, I guess. And then the byproduct of that is also just continually talk about the brain and mind so that it gets greater awareness and raise a bit of money.
As I said before, I think it's a really important contribution at lots of levels for those with brain injury, brain disease, but also beyond that, I'm sure that there are deep lessons that people can tap into. The book is Eyes of Silence, written by Doug Spann. Doug, thank you so much indeed for coming in and sharing your story with us on Open House.
Pleasure, Lee. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.